So tonight I'm going to talk about an intense topic, toxic shame. And the first thing I'll say, I'll talk for a minute about healthy shame. And healthy shame is funny. We really don't need a whole lot of healthy shame. You know, as long as I'm clear on the fact that I'm not God, that I'm not some exalted person, that I'm just on the same level as everyone else, that's all the healthy shame I need. You know, you could say healthy shame is just, it kind of lowers people from an unrealistic high down to the ground where we can be on the same level as everyone else. Now, toxic shame, on the other hand, sort of continues in that direction and pushes me way below everyone else. Toxic shame is the feeling that I am the worst possible being in creation. There's often tremendous disgust and revulsion associated with toxic shame, as if who I am is incredibly repulsive. You know, it's a very powerful, intense negative emotion. And I'll say that I think we live in a time in which this experience is almost epidemic in the United States, you know, the experience of having this emotion. And why would this be? And I'd say that, you know, none of us have had Buddhas as parents, really, you know. And, you know, of course, some people have suffered horrible things in their childhood. But even just the ordinary, you know, ordinary experiences, things that didn't used to even be recognized as harmful can be harmful. I'll read this quote. Even well-meaning adults can sometimes underestimate children's sensitivity to shaming language. There's mounting evidence that some of the words used to scold children, household words previously thought harmless, have the power to puncture children's self-esteem for years to come. And so it's very tricky. One term that I'll present, this was a term created by the psychologist Heinz Kohut. He used the term optimal frustration. And he was talking primarily about kids that are toddler age, like 2 and 3 years old. And of course, there are many occasions in which an adult figure has to say no to a child that age. But how do you say no? And how do you say no in a way that still honors who the child is, honors, you know, their feeling that their internal experience matters? And Heinz Kohut created this phrase, optimal frustration. The idea is that the parent, in saying no, reaffirms the connection. So the child walks away, even though what they're hearing is no, you can't have that particular X that you were asking for. They get the they're reinforced in the feeling that they are loved, that they're accepted for who they are, that their internal experience is valuable. So Heinz Kohut was talking about this primarily as a way that a wise parent would relate to a toddler. I really find this a very useful idea in general, even for, you know, adults in sensitive situations. You know, it can be, you know, an optimal frustration is often exactly what another adult needs to hear in a tender moment, you know. And so it's a powerful concept. And so I think all of us have had some experience of toxic shame. I think it would be a rare person who got to adulthood with having no experience. And part of it is because that shame is just an extraordinarily effectively good use tool for using to control people, you know. Much of the school system, I think until recently, in some places even now, uses shaming techniques to control children. You know, and certainly religions and social structures have used them. You know, Puritanism was very much a system like that. And so it's this paradox, you know, because, of course, the voice of shame, part of it says, I must be the only one in the world who's experiencing this. And, of course, that's entirely false because almost everybody's experiencing it, you know. But the paradox is that because it's such an intensely difficult experience to face head on, there are thousands of strategies for, you know, dysfunctionally avoiding this experience. And I'll presence, I'm going to list some of these ways that people avoid toxic shame. I'm going to presence that this is really the only time in my Dharma talks that I've ever had a cheat sheet, just because there were so many examples. I had to write them down to remember this whole list of all the examples. So again, toxic shame is the experience that I'm the lowest creature in creation, you know. And so anything I can do to even get myself above one other person, then that's kind of a relief. Then it's like, whoa, okay, at least I'm not the lowest thing right now because that person's below me, you know. And so, first of all, any kind of, you know, put downs of any sort, you know, emotional put down, it can be, you know, a curse laden put down. It could be a very intellectual put down, you know, ha ha, I know this and you don't, you know. Any of those kinds of things, any kind of topping thing, you know, I can do this, you can't, you know, like any kind of topping maneuver, all of those are ways to avoid shame. Related to that, moral high ground, you know, anything where, you know, look how good I am. And the idea is that I can, from my place, I can pass judgment on you down there, you know, this sort of thing. Similarly, taking offense. There's a real culture on college campuses, I think, of, you know, almost taking, you know, offense as a badge of pride, like, when you said that, you offended me, you know, and just this, you know, this very, very hyper dramatic way of taking offense. And, you know, the fact that I am offended means that you've done something reprehensible, you know. And related to this, calling out people who have done something wrong. And it's awfully tricky here because, you know, especially say on racial grounds, you know, if I as a white person see another white person do something that's problematic in terms of, you know, it might be racist, it might be something that in some ways implies that people of color are less, I don't want to remain silent because silence is complicity, but how do you speak up? And I think I would say, if we can speak up from, and this is where, incidentally, the optimal frustration is quite valuable. Can I speak up in a way of saying, of reaffirming the connection and saying, you know, I found what you said problematic there. Can we discuss it, you know, from a balanced sort of place? That's very different. A shame-driven response would be to condemn, you know, you're a racist, you're a bad person, you know, to go to the moral high ground kind of thing, rather than we're at the same level, let's converse about it. Another variety of behaviors induced by toxic shame, certainly perfectionism. You know, the idea of, you know, I'm terrified to make a mistake, so I'm going to be perfect with everything. You know, related to this, all the codependent kinds of behaviors of, I'm going to fix, I'm going to save other people and not even admit that I myself have needs. You know, the nice guy, the good girl, all these patterns. Of course, the good girl, what she's trying to do is she's trying to save the man. You know, she gets involved with the troubled guy and she's trying to save the guy. You know, and it's all about trying to save him, you know, whereas her needs are getting neglected, you know, and it's this whole worldview because of the shame. My needs don't matter. I only matter if I'm taking care of somebody else, you know. So another example is kind of the all or nothing sort of judgment, you know, very, you know, I mean, any kind of judgment, any kind, especially, you know, black and white, you know, this is good, this is evil, you know, extreme sort of judgment. And along those lines, think about the groups, especially the, you know, the stereotypical religious groups, you know, the small group that says, you know, we're all saved, you know, in our little community, and everyone else is going to hell, you know. And what's odd about that is, how to say it, the people in the group in speaking that message are giving an outpicturing of what's going on in their psyches. Because in their psyches, they've created this tiny little place, this, you might say, like a walled city of safety. You know, as long as I believe this, I'm safe. And then everything else in their psyche is toxic shame. And toxic shame in some ways is the experience of hell, you know? And so everything outside their little walled city of safety is hell. And so that's the message they're promulgating outward about how the world is, you know? And it's a sad thing about America. We're such a word-drunk culture, and so many people have so little idea of what the sacred actually is, that when people give that message, it actually sounds plausible to some people, you know? Another experience of toxic shame has to do with any kind of othering. And shame is exactly what leads us to create inward othering. You know, the places that hold shame, you know, whether it's anger, whether it's sadness, whether it's fear, you know, sexuality, all, if it holds shame, then we other ourselves from that. Oh, that's not me. Oh, I'm not the type of person who feels that at all, you know? And when we have these strong sort of polarized inner othering, we tend to see the world in terms of othering. And so there'll be other groups and whoever it is, other races or people in prison or gay people or refugees, you know, some other that is the source of all evil, you know, just as the place other in me feels like a source of all evil. And I'll say also along these lines, racism itself is, among other things, an incredible system of shaming. And it has been used by white people to shame and control people of colors. And that's the most pernicious part about racism, that it gets so deeply internalized, you know. I believe it was Stephen Biko who said the greatest weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And of course, toxic shame leads to violence often, you know. If I'm a person given to, you know, physicality and, you know, not particularly, you know, exposed to spiritual traditions, well, then if somebody starts saying something to me that brings up my shame, then all the rejection and revilement that I feel to myself, I'm also going to feel to that person. And it's not going to be a stretch that I might, you know, just want to physically attack that person to, you know, push away that threat, you know. I think a lot of spousal abuse is along these lines, a lot of you know, domestic violence. You know, and of course, the abuser is often someone who was abused. You know, it's a classic pattern, you know, and it's so predictable in a way that the young child is abused, they're feeling powerless. What any child wants is to be empowered, to be like my adult figure, you know? Well, if my adult figure is an abuser, then it imprints this very powerful pattern. I am powerful when I'm abusing, you know? And so it's very, very sad how that plays out. And then, of course, anything like a gang, for example, in some ways, a gang functions very similarly as the tight religious community. You know, we're all saved. Everyone else is going to hell. The gang, you know, they're only faithful to each other. And everyone else is, you know, anyone against us, other gangs or cops, they all should die, you know. And so that's just sort of an overview of the variety of ways in which toxic shame plays out in the world. Competitiveness. It's astonishing how many everyday behaviors give evidence of toxic shame. So what can we do about this? How can we heal toxic shame? There's a wonderful quote I'll read by Brené Brown, who has wonderful things to say on this topic. She says, "If you put shame in a petri dish, it needs three things to grow exponentially: secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you can put the same amount of shame in a petri dish and douse it with empathy, it can't survive." And one powerful antidote to shame is finding those safe spaces. Now, sometimes it's with a therapist, or if you're lucky, you can find a group of friends, you know, a men's group, a women's group, something like this, where you can actually speak the thing that is shameful. And it's such a hard thing to do, you know, because it's, you know, exactly what shame wants to do is hide. And so it takes so much courage to speak it. But if you're really in a place where you know you're going to get the emotional support and the mirroring, then it can be the most healing thing in the world to speak it and have other people say me too, or have other people, you know, acknowledge you and give you props for speaking it. That can be very powerful, you know. And short of having the opportunity to speak it out, you can even do things like, you know, write the shameful things on a piece of paper, then burn the paper, you know, or, you know, anything just to move it so that it's not just inside, you know, write the paper, you know, bless the paper, put incense on it, and then burn it, or, you know, whatever you want to do. You know, or drive your car to an empty parking lot and shout it at the top of your lungs or something like that. Anything that moves it so that it's not just in secrecy, silence, and hiding. Ultimately, what heals shame is self-love and self-acceptance. And I think the way I'll say it is, I often say that emotional pain, shame and other emotional pain, it's a lot like inner advertising. And so like advertising, it has a message that's very loud. It has a message that is often repeated, almost redundantly repeated. And like advertising, the verbal content of that message contains almost zero truth value, you know? And so pain is saying something very insistently as if it's the God-given truth. And often it's not true at all, you know? And it's an important thing, you know, because the mind is so gullible. It gets duped by words. You know, verbal information comes and the mind says, oh, well, that must be the truth, you know. And it's so important to develop that kind of skepticism about what the voice of pain is saying. Like, all right, well, I hear that. Is that really true? You know? And one way to think about it is if you think about, say, a wise parent of a 2 or 3 year old, you know, a 2 or 3 year old may be having a temper tantrum. Say it's, you know, they're up past their bedtime or something like this, and they lose control of themselves, and then they're in this temper tantrum. And of course, a 2 year old in a temper tantrum is going to say all kinds of things. You know, I hate mommy, I hate daddy, I want to run away, you know, all kinds of stuff will come out of the child's mouth, the wise parent is able to completely discount the verbal content of what's coming out of the infant's mouth and attend to the infant's real needs. You know, the wise parent is thinking, this child is overtired, needs to go to bed. And so despite the verbal barrage, they're ignoring the content of the verbal barrage. They're just trying to get them to bed, you know? And so think about your own places of pain, which are often wounded inner children, you know? That place of pain has all this verbal content that's coming out. That verbal content, in a way, doesn't matter at all. The actual verbal meaning of whatever is being said by the pain, can you relate to it, more or less discounting the verbal message, but attending to the real need there? And often that's a very good inquiry for on the journey of self-love. All right, I feel this pain. I hear the message it's saying. I'm not going to pay attention to that. But what's the real need there? You know, is it love? Is it acceptance? Is it forgiveness? You know. The deep truth of our existence is that we are all precious. The deep truth of our existence is that we are all profoundly lovable, that we are worthy of love, respect, admiration, complete acceptance. That is our birthright. That is our human birthright. It belongs to every human being on this earth. No one can take it away, you know? That's the deep truth. But I often like to say that pain is loud, but love is truer and deeper, you know? And often inside the place of pain, you know, the place of pain might have this, you know, message of, you know, you're the worst, you're horrible, you don't deserve to be alive, you know, whatever message is coming. But when we're able to actually love it and receive it, then it opens up, then there's tenderness inside, you know? And that's been my experience over and over again, to approach, you know, a screaming, raving, you know, maniac part of myself. And then when it softens and opens, it's just this, the sweetest tenderness inside it. And so to again have that vision, because the work of healing is hard. It's hard to walk toward those places in us that are wounded, you know. It's hard, and especially if we're believing the voice of pain, which is saying, I'm going to be forever. You're never going to heal me. You know, like whatever the pain is saying. To hold that vision that there's really love and tenderness inside. So I'll share the quote sheet. So I have the two quotes at the top that I already read. Then from the Buddha, a wonderful quote, you could search through the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of love and affection than you are yourself, and that person is not to be found anywhere. Carl Jung says, quite simply, the most terrifying thing is to accept oneself completely. Anais Nin says, shame is the lie someone told you about yourself. John Bradshaw, in a really classic book, shame is internalized when one is abandoned. Abandonment is the precise term to describe how one loses one's authentic self and ceases to exist psychologically. This beautiful one from Rachel Naomi Raymond, who says, wounding and healing are not opposites. They're part of the same thing. It is our wounds that enable us to be compassionate with the wounds of others. It is our limitations that make us kind to the limitations of others. It is our loneliness that helps us to find other people or even to know they're alone with an illness. I think I have served people perfectly with parts of myself I used to be ashamed of. And so the old archetype of the wounded healer, you know, it's precisely because the healer has been through wounding and has confronted their own wounding, that's what makes them a healer, you know. Byron Katie says quite simply, do you want to meet the love of your life? Look in the mirror. Maureen Brady says, our need to be greater than or less than has been a defense against toxic shame. A shameful act was committed upon us. The perpetrator walked away, leaving us with the shame. We absorb the notion that we are somehow defective. To cover for this, we construct a false self, a masked self. And that self is the overachiever or the dunce, the tramp or the Puritan, the power monger or the pathetic loser. And one thing I'll say connected to that, toxic shame can be one of the things that makes it hardest to experience healthy shame, you know? And so if toxic shame is up for me, one place I might go is inflating myself completely. You know, I'm much better than everyone else, you know? It's so hard for me to experience healthy shame because toxic shame is so overwhelming, you know? Orson Scott Card says, in my view, suicide is not really a wish to end life. What is it? The only way a powerless person can find to make everyone else look away from his shame. The wish is not to die, but to hide. And I think I would add to that, I think it's often the feeling of someone who's deep in shame, you know, this inability to share it in any way. And so it's this feeling of I'm in all this tremendous pain and no one can hear my pain. No one knows about my pain. And it's almost like suicide is this profound statement. Finally, everyone is going to know how much pain I was in because I could never speak that when I was alive, you know. And so it's very sad that we live in a world where people don't find those connections where they can actually safely speak their pain. Jack Kornfield says, if your compassion does not include yourself, it is incomplete. Debbie Ford says, it would be impossible to estimate how much time and energy we invest in trying to fix, change, or deny our emotions, especially the ones that shake us at our very core, like hurt, jealousy, loneliness, shame, rage, and grief. Brené Brown, of course, she has a lot to say on this subject. She says, empathy is the antidote to shame. The two most powerful words when we're in struggle is me too. And in The Gifts of Imperfection, she says, when we cultivate love, we allow our most vulnerable and powerful selves to be deeply seen and known. And when we honor the spiritual connection that grows from that offering with trust, respect, kindness, and affection. Love is not something we give or get. It is something we nurture and grow, a connection that can be cultivated between two people when it exists in each one of them. We can only love others as much as we love ourselves. Shame, blame, disrespect, betrayal, and withholding of affection damage the roots from which love grows. Love can only survive these injuries if they are acknowledged, healed, and are rare. Christopher Dine says, spiritual and emotional recovery are possible because the human brain is a living organism that we can transform by making new choices and being in non-shaming, recovery-based environments. And I think I would say at an energetic level, we are surrounded by healing all the time. We are surrounded by love and acceptance all the time. And it's almost the paradox of human life that we walk around feeling so disconnected, but we're walking around in this energetic sea of healing, and we really just have to get out of our own way to allow this healing in, you know. Linda Graham says, there's a teaching from the Buddhist tradition. If you take a teaspoon of salt and stir it into a glass of water and take a sip of the glass, ick, the water is too salty to drink. If you take a teaspoon of water and stir it into a large lake, and then after a bit take a glass from the lake and sip that from that glass, the salt is completely dissolved in the vastness of the lake. You can't taste it at all. This is a useful metaphor for working with any afflicting experience. holding it in spacious awareness so that the painful moment is barely a blip on the radar. When mindfulness is steady enough, compassion for what is arising in awareness and in the moment is consistent enough, we can hold, process, and let go whatever gets stirred up again and again from the mucky bottoms of our psyche, even toxic shame. Linda Poindexter says, one small crack does not mean you are broken. It means you were put to the test and you didn't fall apart. And finally, Dr. Bernard Golden says, breaking through the bubble of shame requires the cultivation of awareness, self-reflection, and some degree of optimism that, in spite of the thoughts we experience, we can ultimately loosen their hold. Being open to self-compassion involves recognizing and accepting the hurt aroused from your past wounds, those that may contribute to the tendency toward shame. It often calls for making peace with an early version for yourself. It calls for acknowledging that it is easy to beat yourself with hindsight over the limited awareness you may have had in your past. That last quote rings very true. You know, there's so many ways that now I have the wisdom, and boy, I would have been much better if I had it in the past, that kind of thing.